Welcome to all of you to this very special roundtable discussion today. On behalf of the director of the Arnaudy Center, Frederik Logevall, I would like to very specially welcome you. I'm Heike Michelsen. I'm the director of programming at the Arnaudy Center. And I leave it up to Tim DeFolk, the director of the Latin American Studies Program, to introduce our very special guest that we have here with us from Cuba. Unfortunately, and contrary to what he had in the official program, we were not able to welcome here today Isabel Pascual Alonso, who unfortunately couldn't get a visa to come here. So instead, we have organized this very special discussion over Skype, and we really hope and keep our fingers crossed that the technical aspects will all work out with our panel. So this event is jointly organized by the Latin American Studies Program here at Cornell and the Arnaudy Center, and it's part of a series that we started a few years now ago, a roundtable discussion series that really tries to feature different experts in international affairs who can address topical and current issues from a number of different perspectives. And it's just another flagship program and initiative that we have as part of our Foreign Policy Forum. And this forum emerged from the understanding that we really have to contribute to a lot of the current debates that are ongoing, and Cornell has a lot to do and to contribute in this area. And I think what better than to choose a topic like the new U.S.-Cuban relationships. So we're very grateful for organizing this event and definitely for the support from the Bartels family. Without this all wouldn't be possible. So in the past, Cornell has engaged with Cuba, but focusing on ecology, ornithology, and Professor DeVolk has developed and designed a program for undergraduate science students to spend a semester at the University of Havana and assist faculty members in research. But now, given the chance of the new diplomatic relations between our two governments, participants in the roundtable today will discuss the implications towards future research and collaboration. Again, I welcome all of you, and particularly Professor Tim DeVolk, who will introduce all the speakers of today. Thank you.
I'd like to welcome all of you as well. Most of you would know that Cuba has been a conundrum for the United States for the last 50 years. I'm going to make the case for even longer than that. Most of you would know as well that the United States has been a conundrum for Cuba for the last 50 years, and I'm going to make the case longer than that as well. This is a great time to be discussing changes. It's the changes originate at the very top with our president and with the leader of Cuba right now. It's not clear where things are going to go. It's not clear how fast they'll go. And so what I'd like to do is give you, those of you that may not be completely up to date on it, give you a quickie tour of Cuban history, and then we'll start talking with Lynn Roche, who is at the U.S. interest section in Havana, and a very special piece of today's presentation will be interactions with the first Cornell students to be at the University of Havana. And then we have Ken Roberts and Gustavo Flores Macias from our government department, and Eduardo Inigo Elias from the Laboratory of Ornithology, who are welcome to make comments about different aspects of what you hear. So with that as the preamble, what I'd like to do, if we can make the technology work, is switch over to my PowerPoint for a few minutes, and then we'll go into the other comments. Columbus landed at Cuba when he sailed from Spain in 1492. Within a few years, there were a number of cities founded in Cuba. Within a few years, the indigenous population was either dead or slaves. And Cuba became a base point for shipping riches from the Western Hemisphere back to Spain. This is El Moro Castle, which was where Spain in Cuba tried to prevent the British, the French, the Dutch, and on occasion or later the Americans, from taking things away. Slavery was legal in Cuba, and in fact, there was a period of time in the 1700s when Britain took possession of Cuba for 2 or 3 years and brought in a great many additional slaves to work the cane fields. I'm going to skip over hundreds of years of history and move to the 1800s when José Martí became the voice of Cuban protest against Spain and ultimately the voice of Cuban independence, although at that point he was dead. Many of you may not know that José Martí traveled widely. He was liable for arrest in Cuba. He spent a great deal of time in the U.S. and in the 1880s, he came to Ithaca. Some of you can read this, the Spanish. I've asked Gustavo if he could translate it for us.
A very rough translation of this would be along the lines of Cornell in Ithaca is a magnificent university. It is the modern university. Note to the academies of pupils where they break them in. Note to the academies where they exploit and neglect them. Note to the literary academies where they do not acquire the benefits of literature, for they forget their own and do not learn the new one. Note to violently disrupting the spirit already shaped by the native winds with a foreign one that contradicts it. Note to this. This is not where we should send Latin American children, but to Cornell University, based on the knowledge and the needs of modern life, without looking down on the good that previous periods had to offer. To Cornell University, where through the fertile work, they acquire the universal tools that modern life requires.
We couldn't say it better today, right? And in fact, in the negotiations I carried out with the University of Havana, this is something I went in with. I said, if you're gonna make a deal with anyone, make it with us, because we have a long history together. José Martí was active with the fighters in Cuba trying to get independence from Spain. All the rest of Latin America had done so in the 18 teens and 20s, and Cuba was still, and Puerto Rico, were still not independent. Much of the Spanish forces had been defeated by the 1890s. Spain was in the process of pulling back, and then the U.S. decided to help things along. And so we sent in soldiers. In the lower picture, they're taking a hill near Guantanamo. In the upper picture, it's the Rough Riders with Teddy Roosevelt attacking some hills in the extreme eastern side of Cuba. We then finished things off that the Cubans themselves had started and assumed that that gave us the right to dictate terms. We took control of Cuba for about 4 years and then gave them the independence that they had been working for. However, under the Constitution that we approved, the U.S. retained the right to intervene in Cuban affairs, to supervise its finances, and to tell them how they should run their foreign relations. Early on as well, the Platt Amendment was passed, under which the U.S. leased the Guantanamo naval base from Cuba in perpetuity. Just a side note here. Since Fidel Castro took over at the end of 1959, the U.S. has continued to pay rent on the Guantanamo naval base. My understanding is that those checks have been piling up in Fidel's desk. Not one of them has ever been cashed. But going back to the early years of the 1900s, Cuba became a party place for the U.S. Under the enlightened leadership of President Batista in the upper left there, he made a deal. He made a deal with the U.S. Mafia in which for payment of somewhere between $250,000 and $1 million, plus more money under the table. Anyone could open a casino, and a great many were opened, supervised by Meyer Lansky, with the occasional help of Frank Sinatra. Ernest Hemingway hung out there, and the ubiquitous ugly American tourist as well. The mafia had a summit at the National Hotel in Cuba in the mid-1950s, where they not only divided up criminal activities in Cuba, they also divided up criminal activities in the US. I talked to an uncle of Alexis Santi a couple of years ago, who could remember as a boy his family flying over to Miami for dinner and then coming back in the evening. Miami and Havana are closer together than we are to New York City. And as in this picture, there was a great deal of commerce, not all of it salubrious, going back and forth in the 1950s. Starting in 1956 and continuing to 59, Fidel Castro led a revolution, ultimately successful. There remains a lot of controversy about how the estrangement occurred between the US and Cuba. Certainly the story is told differently in Cuba than it is here. In any case, fairly quickly, there were many people who became refugees and left Cuba and wanted to defeat Fidel. They formulated a plan to invade Cuba. Castro and his government found out details about the plan and defeated the invading force at the Bay of Pigs in April 1961. I've been there, and there are billboards mile after mile saying, this is where our commanding general set up his headquarters. This is where our troops massed. This is where the furthest advance of the Yankee invaders, and this is the place where they set foot in Cuba. It's still regarded as a high point in Cuban history that the invasion was put down. There's a museum there that shows some of the military equipment used by the Cubans to do this. A year and a half later was the Cuban Missile Crisis. My colleagues from history and government know many more of the details than I do, but I think the consensus is that by staging a half-assed invasion, there were many people in the world who thought that the US had sort of lost its mind and thought that it would be possible to put weapons in Cuba without our really mounting much of a coherent defense. In fact, it seemed like a quid pro quo, given that we were installing missiles in Turkey a few hundred miles away from Russia. Why couldn't Russia put some missiles in Cuba a few hundred miles from us? In October, our overflights found the missiles, and our flights over cargo ships in the ocean revealed jet fighters that were being brought to Cuba. Major crisis. Ultimately, a deal was struck between Nikita Khrushchev and President Kennedy, saying, we're both going to back away. You're going to promise that you never invade Cuba. We're going to promise that we take out all the weapons. And then 50 years of cold relations ensued, where we imposed an embargo on virtually all US goods going to Cuba. Cuba had very strong relations with the Soviet Union, which then, of course, collapsed when the Soviet Union collapsed. There was a desperate time in Cuba then, with the loss of revenue, the loss of basic goods. People in Cuba starved to death during that time. I've talked to people who tried to find grasses that they could cook, who tried to find pets that weren't leashed. It was an awful time in Cuba. And then gradually the Cuban economy, such as it was, came together to at least sustain its own citizens. In recent years, the embargo's been and continued in place. In recent years, the US has had a policy that's been called wet foot, dry foot. in which if a Cuban arrives to the United States by any means and sets foot on the soil in the U.S., he or she can ask for asylum. But if they're interdicted on the high seas, they get sent back to Cuba. In recent years, there's been honest and fruitful collaboration and cooperation in a number of situations. In family issues, where if a U.S. parent takes a child to Cuba that he or she doesn't have permission to take, the Cubans return the child, and vice versa. In hijackings, there was a period of time in the 70s when people would hijack airplanes and take them to Cuba. U.S. and Cuba signed a deal where hijackings in either direction get returned. In drugs, Cuba is, if anything, more anti-drug than the U.S. is, and the two countries work together in drug interdiction. In environment and conservation, which is a place where Eduardo has had interactions with Cuba. Now, I became interested in Cuba. I first went, I think, about three and a half years ago. And I have a couple of stories. I had a whole list here, as you see. I have just a couple of stories that, for me, illustrate what it's like to be interacting with Cuba. And until you do it, until you spend some time there, until you realize you don't realize the extent to which things are not as they seem, are not another developing Latin American country, but are different. Skipping around, a friend of mine from Germany went with some Cuban scientists to catch bats for research. Where do you catch bats? In a cave. And so they went to a large cave and started looking for bats. And when they came out, there were heavily armed soldiers right outside asking them what the hell they were doing in the cave. They tried to explain that they were scientists going after bats. And any of you who are biologists know that when you try to explain what you do, most people don't really get it. And so they had to spend the night in jail. It turned out that this was just a few years ago. It turned out that in the back of the cave, there were weapons and tanks that had been placed there as reserve materials for when the U.S. invades. Official government policy is that the U.S. is still planning on invading and that the Cubans need to be prepared for this. It works both ways. I was working at the State Department 5 years ago. I applied through channels within the State Department and within the Treasury Department for permission to go to a conference in Cuba. I indicated that it was legitimate. I got permission to go to the conference on the day of the conference. There was a way in which both sides continued to, at that point, to a degree still, work to keep each other apart. I was invited to give a talk at the Cuban Institute of Neuroscience. And then when the date came close, I was told that unfortunately scheduling conflicts had come up and that they would have to schedule it for some other undefined time. I accepted that, those things happen, and was later told by some of the students from the place, once they became friends and once they trusted me, I was later told that in the in-between time, the head of the institute had decided that I had to be a CIA spy, that there was no other reason I could possibly be there. I've been in the homes of a number of Cubans who live in big apartment buildings in Havana. And in virtually every one, there's some free enterprise person who has put a TV antenna on the roof of the apartment building and has run cable down through the apartment building, charging $1 or $2 a month to get Miami TV. And facing a fine of upwards to $1,000 if he or she is ever discovered, because it's illegal to do this. You have to remember that any person employed legally in Cuba is making somewhere on the order of $30 or $35 a month. And in spite of the paranoia, in spite of the long history of bad relations, over the last 2 years, starting with me and continuing with Cornell Abroad, we've created an agreement with the University of Havana in which our students can go and be in classes part-time and be in research labs part-time. And here's an illustration of some of this with Emmanuel Mora, who's in the upper left, who is one of the people coordinating the research there. Upper right are people in his lab, and bottom shows students associated with biology and neurosciences in Cuba. That part is really neat and exciting. And then you look around Havana and you see how drab, how run down, how much there is that would need to be done if Cuba's ever to be one of the more prosperous Latin American countries. Of course, things are changing. Of course, that's the reason we're having this meeting today. Fidel and Barack are talking, literally talking, face to face. So the question then is, what happens next? Is there hope for the future between the US and Cuba? I saw that when I was there in January. Let me transfer the things back again, and hopefully it's all going to work. So hopefully now we will join Lynn Roche, who's the public affairs officer for the US in Havana. She's been instrumental in coordinating high-level visits that have been going on from the US to Cuba. She's also been helpful to us in making our students feel at home there. We have her on the video now. Hi, Lynn. And hopefully the voice. Good. And on the left of the screen is Ian Pengra, who I think is from CALS. And on the right is Wesley Schnapp, who is from ARTS. They are Cornelians, and they are ones who are the pioneers in this program. And take it away, guys. I'd like to hear your thoughts, Lynn, about how things are changing and what's going to happen next. I'd like to hear some stories from Ian and Wesley about how you do research in Cuba, how you celebrate May Day in Cuba, or anything else they care to tell us about.
Okay, great, thanks. Sorry we had slipped off there for a little bit. And it's really great to be, I have to say, back there at Cornell, because I worked at the Center for International Studies for the Peace Studies Program in 1979 to 1982. So I'm not sure if anyone in the room was around then, but anyway, nice to be back. A couple things on just a little bit of how things are going from the perspective here at the US Interest Section. And I'm not sure if I can tell you where things are going, but maybe what we think will be coming up. It's really a time of tremendous opportunity. I'm in my third year now in Havana, and we can see the increasing engagement on both sides. Not just because of what the two presidents said on December 17th, but also of what's been happening over the past couple years. The opening for academic exchanges that the Obama administration made in 2009, some more in 2011, we've seen an increase in the number of American universities and students, professors, who are engaging with Cuban academic institutions. The same is for some of the changes happening here in Cuba, especially in January of 2013 when they made changes to their immigration law and Cubans did not have to receive an exit permit to travel. So that more coming and going from both sides has really opened up the dialogue a lot on all sorts of areas. If we're looking at marine conservation, looking at the arts, looking at English language instruction and learning languages, many, many different fields, there's just been a lot more happening between the two countries over the past couple of years. The current initiative from December 17th is changing the direction of U.S. Cuba policy has been enormous. Lots of expectations here, lots of expectations in the U.S. There is, I think, general sense of that we are working in this direction. We heard it from both presidents that said we will reestablish diplomatic relations. We will open embassies in each other's capitals. So we're working in that direction. We're not quite sure when that will be yet, but in the next couple months, I would say it'll happen in the next year, within the next year, and we'll see. In terms of the interaction and engagement between our two countries, we've also seen that step a lot. It's December 17th. Some of that are Americans and others taking advantage of the change in the OFAC regulations for this Cuba. And some of that is just a sense that there's more that we can talk about and different directions we can go. It doesn't mean that all the limitations have been removed on both sides. There are still limitations from the US side, equally some limitations, and there's still a sense that we're waiting for response on the Cuban side to see where things are going and we're willing to take on, what they're willing to engage, and where we can find some common ground, some mutual interest. Just by way of background, and as I mentioned before, that there has been a lot going on between the two countries, and things are growing, is that even though we do not have diplomatic relations, we are the largest mission here in Havana. So we have probably one of the biggest buildings, but also have staff of any other foreign mission. We are now the second largest source of visitors to Cuba after Canada. And many of those, of course, are Cuban Americans coming back to visit family and friends, but that's it. We're also the second largest source of foreign exchange. A good portion of that is from remittances, which are at about $3 billion a year. And about $500 million sales, food, and other items. That was the number from 2013. It goes up and down a little bit, but roughly that. Where we are, say, in terms of the U.S. interest section, is looking to build out, heading in the direction of the normal embassies exchange programs with Cuba. And you probably have experienced in many other countries where you know that there is an international visitor program, there may be Fulbright programs, free programs, the Study U.S. Institutes, a number of programs that are on the regular menu of academic, educational, and cultural exchange programs offered through the Department of State. So we start those as the international visitor program slowly with in small numbers over the past couple of years. And now we have also an agreement with the Cuban authorities, with the government of Cuba, to have a candidate for Humphrey Fellowship in the fall of 2016. The other part, aside from working specifically with the Cuban government on some of these exchanges, is looking for different targets of opportunity to where U.S. government and State Department either support or facilitation can make exchanges grow. And that's, I think, where we are with Cornell, where we're there with some other universities and different kinds of programs as well, where we can perhaps provide some either human resources, financial resources, or communication that might facilitate an exchange program, especially if it's Cubans visiting the United States. One of the other areas, just to mention kind of as a at the end, is that we're also looking to build out our ability to support English language teaching in Cuba for the past couple of weeks, mostly teaching English, but we're looking at ways that we can support better language learning and toward that end, so more Cuban students could participate in programs in the States. And along with that is being able to begin offering ETS, educational test services, here in Havana and perhaps other parts of the country, so that Cuban students could take the regular standardized tests. There's still a lot to overcome. We're in the process of looking for different steps that will build confidence between the U.S., that is, say, U.S. government, and Cuban institutions. So that's important for us. Important to find ways to connect with young Cubans, young students, and young educators. One of the tremendous pieces to look at, which we've talked about as well, is financial support, because of the difference between our two countries and the cost of education. So that's something that is out on the table. And a concern as well for Cuban authorities will be Cuban students and making opportunities for them to return to Cuba. That is, why should they study in the United States and return to Cuba and not stay in the United States? Too many young Cubans are still trying to get to the United States and stay, and we would really like to see that the educational exchanges, the academic or scientific exchanges are opportunities to go to the States, but then back to Cuba and participate in their country's future. So I'll kind of stop there, and I don't know, Ian, do you want to?
Well, let me just toss something in here, which I wanted to mention to you folks, which is that Lynn has been able to come up with funding for two Cuban students to come to Cornell this summer. And so that is a marvelous opportunity for those two people. And with what she said about starting up the Humphrey program, I wanted to pass on to you, Lynn, that I think we have somewhere between, I don't know, 12 and 15 Humphrey people each year here at Cornell, and we would love to host the start of that program as well.
Thanks, Tim.
So I guess I can start with doing research in Cuba. It's really interesting doing research in Cuba because there's really, really smart, passionate professors and students in here who a lot of the time don't necessarily have access to the same kinds of funding that research it does in the States. I'm thinking specifically of our professor Emmanuel Mora, and he's a really passionate guy, and every time you talk to him, he's just always like thinking of questions and thinking of experiments. And his focus on looking for really important questions to ask that you can access with limited technology is really inspiring to me. And it really like the sense of Cuban ingenuity really comes through with him in his experimental, when he's helping us build experiments and ask really like important questions that need to be asked, and how do we address those questions. It's just really like, it's an amazing experience being able to work with such like brilliant people, and it's I'm really grateful that like I've been able to come here and do research here with some amazing professors, even though like it's not necessarily something that you would expect that you can have like top-notch research happening in a developing country. It's absolutely the case here.
It's not easy.
Yeah.
And also, even beyond the research, just being here in Cuba is such a great experience, and how we can kind of couple that with this really cool experience of research. Taking classes at the University of Havana and learning about the culture and kind of being involved in this change is really interesting and a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So would either of you like to give us some specific examples? I'm thinking here of your owl, if you'd like to tell us about that. I also, Wesley, I talked to your mother yesterday, and she said that you happened to get up very, very early on Friday, and so.
Yeah, that was, on Friday was May Day. So a socialist holiday basically Workers' Day, Labor Day in Cuba. And so basically on this day, the entire country wakes up at 6 a.m. earlier and goes into the streets and marches to the Plaza de la Revolución and, carrying signs, chanting about Viva la Revolución and Viva Cuba Libre, and it was an interesting experience. There were thousands of people walking and marching all around us, and I don't know, I think Raul Castro was out there somewhere. I didn't see him, but it was really cool.
Yeah, and the president of Venezuela was on the Plaza de la Revolución also. And there was dozens of like signs for socialist solidarity of like pro Venezuela signs of there was also like groups of people who, for example, worked in CUPET, the National Cuban Petroleum Company. People would organize that everyone gets matching uniforms so that you could tell that this was like the CUPET, the group of people of CUPET workers marching together and in solidarity with the revolution. And yeah, it was a crazy, pretty like quintessentially Cuban experience to see all that happening at once.
So maybe this would be a good point to ask the other people in the panel if they have questions for Lynn or for the students.
I'd be curious in knowing just what your actual research or your studies entail. Is there a particular course of study or particular research projects that you're working on?
Yeah, so our research has to do with the bioacoustics of bats. And so we're working with Emmanuel on, first of all, we're doing a specific research project about distress calls for bats, and we are studying what indicates the urgency of the distress call. And so we have come up with an experiment hypothesis that basically has to do with what indicates the urgency, which is, I guess, non-linearity. We're still figuring it out because we don't have the results yet. But we go out to the field about every week for 6 or 7 hours and collect data. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah, so just to clarify, a distress call is when a bat gets captured by, say, an owl or a boa constrictor. It makes this sound that's in the audible range of like less than 20 kilohertz. And so we want to kind of piece that apart to get at what's fundamentally saying whether this is an extremely urgent distress call or whether this is something that maybe isn't so urgent. So what we're doing is Emmanuel, for one of his previous students' master's thesis, recorded 100 of distress calls from different species, and so we're using those distress calls, and then we modify them in different ways. For example, we played with the order of the syllables, we played with or of the pulses of the distress call, we played with the duty cycle. We were playing with different parameters, basically see which parameters can elicit a supernormal response. And we're measuring response as the number of echolocations per minute. So basically, the amount that bats in the air are paying attention to the source of the distress call, which is just a loudspeaker next to a sort of an owl dummy. And oh, to talk about the owl dummy. What Tim was talking about a little earlier. That was a whole project in itself. So in Cuba, we don't exactly have something like you can't just go to a Walmart and buy a stuffed owl, because nothing like that exists. So what we had to do was make a paper mache owl, and then we had to cover it with feathers somehow. So what we ended up doing was Emmanuel found a dead, desiccated bird while he was walking down the beach one day, and then he brought it to us, and then we had to pull the feathers of this dead bird. So we had that feathers, and then we had to make a paper mache owl, and glue all these feathers onto the paper mache owl so that it looked like, that it actually looked like an owl, so that the bats would have something, so that the bats would have something to direct their echolocation at, to make it an ecologically relevant experiment. Because the idea is that we're simulating a situation where an owl caught a bat, and this bat is emitting different kinds of distress calls. And so to make the owls, it wasn't just us two, it was Emmanuel went, talked to one of his faculty friends and in the psychology department, and asked for a bunch of their undergraduates to come and help us make these paper mache owls. It probably took like 30, 40 man hours of work to make. It was such as a big like collaboration between us just to make this like paper mache owl, which like in the United States we probably could have just bought a taxidermy owl, but that is just not a reality that's at all accessible in Cuba.
We gotta be creative.
So other questions here.
Can you tell us more about your experience in Cuba with Cuban students? You have talked about your experience with Emmanuel as a professor in University of La Habana, but how is your interactions with other students at University of La Habana?
Yeah, so like I said, we are taking, we're taking one class at the University of La Habana, which is just a Spanish class, but we're also living with almost 40 exchange students in our house, and so they're mostly, all of them are taking classes at the University of Havana. They're taking four or five classes there. So they're meeting more students in the university. They're able to meet more. So we've been able to make a lot of friends in the university through them. And we're able to participate in university events where we can talk with the university students and talk about their life here and, you know, whatever, be friendly with them.
I'm also auditing a course until it ended in history and theory of Marxist-Leninism, which is a pretty Cuban class, just by the name alone. And that's all Cuban students with a couple of foreign students who are just taking it. And I would say, I definitely have made a lot of friends of Cuban students, and I don't know, it's, I would say that our interactions with Cuban students was really just like any other interactions with American students, except for the fact that there's a lot more curiosity of how each other's cultures works. For example, one day I was just sitting in class, and then I started talking to the person next to me, and then she just told me how her friend was trying to go to Miami, and she was leaving he was leaving like sometime later in the year, and I don't know, that was just, like the thing that came to mind. We also have a lot of Cuban in the university, and then also we're friends with our neighbors, and we just go out. I go out and play dominoes with them sometimes, like midnight to like 2 a.m. And what else? Interactions with Emmanuel. amazing. He's an incredible, like, he's become a huge source of inspiration for me.
And something that's really cool that we did that outside the city is we went to the field to go do work, and it was in the backyard of this farm, so we were able to kind of get a look at the culture there and how they do all this farm work and what their life is like there and how they're always constantly working. You know, they get so little money, and you know, so we were able to kind of get that side of Cuba as well, which was really interesting.
One thing that really has always stuck out to me about like all my interactions with Cubans, but especially in the countryside, is how really open people are to just share everything.
Yeah.
The little that they have. Like when we went to the cave this weekend, and we stayed on this water buffalo river. They were just bringing out. They brought out like a leg of chicken. They brought out some blocks of like water buffalo cheese, water buffalo milk, a bowl of soup. Like they really brought out like everything that was in their fridge, and they offered it to us. And these are people who were like making $6 a month, and it wasn't because we were Americans. It wasn't because we had money. It was just because we were their guests. They just wanted to share everything that they had with us. And it's really interesting that the common sentiment with every Cuban that I've met is that the governments are doing their own thing, clashing on one level, but the people just, there's no sense of conflict between Cubans and Americans here. That the embargo is, everyone here, at least the embargo is something that happens between the Cuban government and the American government, not the Cuban people and the American people. And that's been something that has like really stuck with me, that I was expecting some kind of like hostility or unhappiness at the fact that like we're Americans and America has been making life incredibly difficult for Cuba for the last 50 years. But I really haven't felt any of that. People are just really, really open.
Do any of you have questions for Lynn? What are the chances that President Obama will visit before the end of his term?
Well, that depends on how quickly we can reestablish relations and raise the flag. So it's a priority for our government. We're negotiating details. We're kind of down to, you know, a couple of pieces still on the table that both sides believe are important for being able to open embassies and function like embassies. So I think that's, you know, sort of where we are. But as Ian mentioned, the course of just basic engagement and human relations, and even our relations as official Americans here, are moving along at a pretty quick pace. There are things that aren't going to happen until we have diplomatic relations, but there's a lot that is happening. And I think that's the policy really of the administration. President Obama's announcement was that engagement is what's going to make the difference in how our two countries can move forward as neighbors. So it's a busy time. I'm not going to be able to predict when President Obama might come, but I'm sure that's on the table, on someone's table. Thanks.
And I'm wondering at this point what you guys think. Would it be better for us to be talking about the things that we've just been hearing, or would it be better to get some questions for the Havana people as long as we have the connection?
I have one question. You mentioned earlier, Lynn, that one of the issues that still affecting the policies in the U.S. and Cuban is the wet, dry, and wet food policy, which is only applies to one country in the world, and that's Cuba. And that has led to many Cuban scientists, especially young scientists and young students, to leave their families, their society, and look for refuge here in the U.S. When they arrive in the U.S., sometimes this has happened. It had happened to Cornell Do you know, with this new era of relationships, if it's going to be possible that that is going to be changed? Because many Cubans are worried that that policy will change, and some people are jumping into the ocean trying to come back to the shores in the U.S., risking their lives. Do you know anything about it? What is happening?
Well, for the Cuban Investment Act, that is still in effect, and that's also a policy that's a law, so that enables Cubans to be able to come to the States, and they essentially are not ever legal in the United States. They can immediately declare that they want to stay in the United States. It's very controversial. It is creating and perhaps has created a lot of discussion, a lot of rumors nowadays about what's happening. It's not something that's being discussed currently in looking at the negotiations for reestablishing embassies, for opening, reestablishing relations and opening embassies. So that's not a piece of it. It's something that is looked at with Senator Obama's reforms, immigration reforms, but also very controversial. It's, as you said yourself, many Cubans now are trying to get to the States so that they can become U.S. legal residents. It's, when do you stop that, or how do you stop that, or how do you create the situation here in Cuba that people are not interested in even trying that? We do work closely with Cuban Border Guard, and our Coast Guard work to try to minimize the dangers for Cubans, but many Cubans are still inclined, they want to take those with us. We continue to look for ways to have safe, legal, and orderly immigration, but the situation here in Cuba, that's still a concern issue for us. I see it changing overnight or changing before we establish relations. It's very controversial in the States. You find one side who says that you think it should still be legal for Cubans to come, that Cubans need that asylum, they need that benefit. And many others who say, well, that they don't. It's a debate, it's also a debate here among Cubans. So I don't see how that will be resolved in the near term, but it is definitely, and people talk about it both in the government and outside the government all the time.
Thank you.
Well, I want to, for the panel, to discuss some of the issues that have been raised here. But maybe before we get to that, do any of you have questions that you'd like to direct to Wesley and Ian, or to Lynn Roche from the interest section? Lynn is part of the consulate. She's, or the interest section. She's not a researcher.
Well, then, in which case, more of a broader question: how are researchers able to continue research?
So to the two of you, Wesley and Ian, the question is: given the kinds of difficulties that you were talking about, how is it possible for researchers to continue doing decent research in Cuba?
I would say hard work, smart people, and creativity. That's really the answer that Emmanuel has been stressing since we got here.
And they do have some equipment. We got some money through Cornell, actually through my mom who donated it, but through a grant to get more equipment. And they get these sorts of grants where they can have money to buy equipment that they can use, although it is limited. It is still possible. And like Ian said, you know, you really just have to deal with what you have and be creative and work hard.
I would say too that again, these changes that have enabled more and more Cubans to travel overseas for conferences, for research, not just to the States, but to Spain or Argentina, to go to Chile, to go to Canada, wherever, that all of that, again, is sort of creating opportunities for academics and researchers to establish better contacts and keep in touch with the rest of the world and do a lot of joint research.
What advice would Ian or Wesley have for U.S. students who want to or desire to go and study at Cuba? What do they wish they knew beforehand?
Alexis is asking what advice you would have for U.S. students who are contemplating going and studying in Cuba, or another way of framing it, are there things that you wish you had known before you got there?
There are definitely a lot of things that I didn't expect that I wish I knew, but then again, I didn't really know what to expect as I was going. Can you think of anything?
Anything you want, bring it to Cuba. because it's almost, there's a lot of things that you just can't find a lot of the time. Like, if you want chocolate, you should bring it with you. If you want hot sauce, bring it with you.
where do you find chocolate? You can buy chocolate.
Yeah, but it's not good.
Sure. Yeah.
No, I'll show you.
Yeah, but I would say little things like that. But
In terms of other things that I didn't expect, I think a lot of it is just, you just kind of have to do trial error kind of things, like kind of learn on your own. I kind of liked that, honestly. It was frustrating at some points, you know, figuring out how to use the internet and figuring out how to use the phone, things like that. I think it's important to do trial and error because it's part of the experience.
Yeah.
But for anything super important, I don't think there was anything else I really needed to know.
Yeah, I think it was mostly just small things, like getting used to living in Cuba with all its difficulties and paradoxes. But I guess the one important thing I would say was the internet situation is basically like you have to either deal with incredibly slow internet at the university. And like sign up for an account there and this, that, and the other thing. Or you can buy internet cards and then go to any hotel, which is only like a 10-minute walk from.
But internet cards takes like 3 hours. Sometimes it takes 2 or 3 hours to get.
Yeah, because you have to stand in a line.
That's systematic.
Yeah.
Anyway, then you get the internet cards, then you have to walk 10 or 15 minutes to the hotel and use it there, but it sometimes doesn't work. And
yeah. So it's a bit of a process, but it's not unbearable. It's definitely like super, super livable. And I think it was an adventure just getting used to living here.
And we have one more question.
This is actually just a very brief infrastructural question. I've been to Cuba a few times and used the internet, and I do not know how this is happening right now, because there's no way I can Skype with anyone from Cuba.
So this is somebody who has been to Cuba and is amazed that we have this Skype connection, and I know the answer to that. It's because the interest section maintains its own system. So they're at the interest section right now, and I believe it's a microwave connection to Miami, which the rest of Cuba doesn't have.
But internet is definitely one of the pieces President Obama's change in direction and policy toward Cuba. And so being able to support access to information, opening up opportunities for telecommunications to be able to meet and talk with Cuban officials how to support broader development in Cuba is really a central piece of the new direction in policy. So we have a little sliver of it here. It's not unlimited bandwidth. It can certainly go down at a moment's notice when we have a thunderstorm, but it does work.
Yeah, just regarding telecommunication, the President Chavez financed a cable that was built from Venezuela to Cuba. This cable was finished in 2013, and now the cable is starting to work. So communications, internet connection is going to improve, and it's improving as we speak. I was just holding a conference in New York.
So some member of the audience is pointing out that President Hugo Chavez paid for a cable from Venezuela. I've heard about this cable starting 3 or 4 years ago, and it wasn't working until recently, and Lourdes is pointing out that there's some evidence that it's starting to be used now. Okay. What I'd like to do is ask the panelists for their thoughts. And you guys are welcome to hang out and hear what they say, or we can hang up the connection right now.
We'll stay on for a bit.
Okay.
Is that where you want to start? Or?
Yeah, I'm happy to start. Thank you all for being here on such a nice day. So I know that the opportunity cost is high, but I appreciate you being here. I often hear that people are confused between what President Obama has done. They're not sure whether this means that the embargo has been lifted. And what President Obama has done and the embargo are two different things. So the embargo is very much in place right now. But I'd like to provide a little bit of context that might be helpful to understand how we got to this point and how things have changed in the relationship, at least from the US side, toward Cuba. Going back to 1917, the Trading with the Enemy Act was established, and it provides sort of discretionary authority to the President of the United States to regulate financial transactions, property transfers by any person in the US with another country. And this has been, in a way, the foundation for many of the policies that have been adopted since. I should say, by the way, that there are three historical, let's say, events that I would like to highlight before I start with this. The first one is the Spanish-American War in 1898. U.S. goes to war with Spain. And this is a little bit how the history of U.S.-Cuba relations, I think, for our purposes, can be better understood. So that is a little bit the first instance that is relevant for our purposes. So in 1898, U.S. goes to war with Spain. The following year, Cuba becomes sort of a protectorate of the U.S. And in 1898, U.S. formally occupies Cuba. In 1901, a new constitution is written based on the U.S. Constitution, and there's what is called the Platt Amendment, which states that the U.S. reserves the right to intervene in Cuban affairs for the preservation of so-called Cuban independence. And then let's fast forward a bit. I mentioned in 1917 this authority that the Trading with the Enemy Act grants a precedent. In 1933, this Trading with the Enemy Act was amended to grant the president this authority, even outside of a war period, sort of claiming more broadly an emergency period. And then in 1962, President Kennedy, exercising discretionary powers of the executive office, directed the Department of Treasury to establish regulations necessary to prohibit imports into the U.S. of all goods of Cuban origin and all goods imported through Cuba, regardless of where they were coming from. this is not the embargo the way we know it today, but it definitely set the foundation. In 1992, the Torricelli Act, the official name, all of these acts have very nice names. This is the Cuban Democracy Act of 1992. And in that act, Congress established it stated that the U.S. was seeking, and I quote, a peaceful transition to democracy and resumption of economic growth in Cuba through, first, the careful application of sanctions directed at the Castro government, and second, support for the Cuban people. Now, these sanctions included limits on the remittances that could be sent to Cuba by U.S. persons. It prohibited vessels from coming to the U.S. Once they had stopped in Cuba, they had to wait 6 months before they could come to U.S. ports. It prohibited the Department of Treasury from issuing licenses authorizing foreign subsidiaries of U.S. companies to engage in trade with Cuba. In 1996, the Helms-Burton Act, which is also known, the official name is the Cuban Liberty and Democratic Solidarity Act of 1996. This affirmed in Section 201, the name of the section is Assistance to a Free and Independent Cuba. And the act affirms that the self-determination of the Cuban people is a sovereign and national right of the citizens of Cuba, which must be exercised free of interference by the government of any country. And then subsequent sections state that the U.S. claims the right to determine which system of governance is permissible in Cuba. Section 205, for example, stipulates that the definition for determining when Cuba would be considered to have a transitional government, and this means that Cuba has to free all political prisoners, has to legalize all political activity, and make a public commitment to organizing free and fair elections. Now, in this act, even if a transitional government were to carry out all of these things I just mentioned, Section 202 still seeks to limit U.S. assistance to this new government, principally to humanitarian aid, to providing things like food, medicine, just emergency, energy, perhaps. And it seeks to prepare the Cuban military forces to adjust to an appropriate role in democracy, right? Whatever that might mean. Now, the definition of a democratic government under this Section 206 stipulates some widely accepted criteria. I think most people would agree, perhaps, that free and fair elections, things like respect for civil liberties, perhaps an independent subsidiary, and so forth. These are widely accepted conditions, perhaps, or things that we associate with a democracy. But part of the definition also stipulates that Cuba must be, and I quote, substantially moving toward a market-oriented economic system, and should show demonstrable progress in returning to U.S. citizens once expropriated property, or providing full compensation for this property. Right. Now, this is very different from what we're seeing today. Right? We've seen, by the way, towards the beginning of President Obama's administration, some reforms that had to do with the easing of the restrictions that were in place. Some of these restrictions were adopted during the Bush administration that had to do with who could travel to the island and the amount that could be sent in as remittances. And some of these things were eased In 2010, another set of reforms, another sort of set of provisions were eased as well. But what we see now announced in 2014, in December, what President Obama did is really a completely different thing, right? The reestablishing of diplomatic relations and opening an embassy in Havana, essentially upgrading this interest section in Havana, is I think, signals a very, very drastic change. Symbolically for the region, this is huge. I think most Latin American countries were very, very pleased by this. And I think it gives a lot of political capital to the United States. There's a poll that I like to quote in my Latin American politics course. This was in 2006 in Argentina. People were asked what their perception was of different world leaders. And they were asked about Fidel Castro, they were asked about Lula, they were asked about President Bush. and the differences were dramatic. So at least, you know, this was a nationally representative survey in Argentina in 2006. Fidel Castro was wildly popular. Lula, let's say, so Castro had about, you know, 70-something percent of the Argentines approved that they liked Fidel Castro. Lula had something like 50-something percent. And President Bush had something like 2%. Approval, President Bush's approval in the U.S. was low, but not that low. But it speaks to the disenchantment in the rest of the region, at least in the hemisphere, with what has been seen as a policy that interferes with not just sort of what Cubans should be able to do, but also what other countries or third parties might want to do with Cuba. Right? So it was seen as a policy that the embargo that really had extraterritorial considerations that were very, very problematic for the region. So I probably I've extended past my allotted time, but I would like to point out that regardless, even though the embargo is still in place, some of these changes are very, very meaningful for the Cuban people. And I think this has very much to do with a very different perspective of diplomacy, one that is based more on, say, modernization theory and the idea that the improvement of economic conditions will make a difference in terms of bringing democracy to the island, as opposed to this punitive approach that has been unsuccessful for a long time.
Thank you, Costello.
Well, I think one of the things I would like to mention to all of you is for the last 14 years, the Lab of Ornithology has been working from here, from Cornell, with four grants, consecutive grants from the MacArthur Foundation, engaging Cuba and Cornell University, teaching and training and building local capacity, not only in La Habana. If you speak to Cubans in the island of Cuba, which by the way is over 3,000 islands and archipelago, not only the main island of Cuba, will say that if you only visit Havana, you don't know Cuba. You need to go out and know the different provinces and know what is happening in Cuba. But one of the things that it was very rewarding for those 14 years working with the Cuban colleagues is that we were able to bring them here to Cornell, professors and students, and spend months of collaboration with many researchers and many fieldwork activities in particularly in bird conservation. And why bird conservation is because we share over 300 species and millions of birds that share the same natural resources with the island. And last week we just have a meeting with US Fish and Wildlife Service, Canadian Wildlife Service, and other agencies in relation to these natural resources that we share. And Cuba continues to be the main point of interest for these resources that we share that we hardly know, and very few, like here, colleagues from Cornell and myself have been able to travel with Cubans. And this is part related to the research question of how do you work in Cuba. And the only way that you work in Cuba is to have Cuban colleagues working with you in the research. And even with that, many areas across the country are not allowed to scientists to visit. And this has more kind of limitation since the 2004, when it was published the Cuba new strategy for a free Cuba by the U.S. government with the Bush administration. But that has changed, and the Cubans hope that in the near future we can continue with that collaboration that we started in the past. And you know, many of us are here, but I think one of the issues that remain controversial also in this relationship is why the panelist that was invited by Tim and his group is not here, still related to issues of visa and being able to travel and be here. And I think I would love more to hear from her, from a Cuban, than we that are not native to the island of Cuba.
I should clarify that she asked for her visa very, very late because she felt that she needed to get permission from her university first, and that there's always an interaction that goes back and forth where when something happens, at least in this case, I think that the fault lies much more with her university than it does with the U.S. consulate there.
Okay. I'll be very, is this what turns it on?
Yeah.
It's on, okay. I'll be very brief, but I just wanted to say a few words about the current moment and the opportunity that we have as scholars or as students and researchers to try to take advantage of this new opening between the United States and Cuba, because I think what you find is that, you know, whatever the political reasons were for the break in diplomatic and economic relationships with Cuba in the past, the reality is that we all lose in many important ways from that. I mean, Cuba is a society that is not only wonderful to visit because it's interesting, but as a student or a researcher, whether you're in the sciences or the social sciences or the humanities, and we heard from our students a few minutes ago about some of the opportunities for scientific research that you can do in Cuba. But let me also say, for a student in the humanities, Cuba has an incredibly rich cultural and literary tradition, a musical tradition, all kinds of opportunities, of course, for language and linguistic studies. And so really it's a loss for us when we don't have access to the cultural richness of Cuba. And so I think I would strongly encourage anyone who has an opportunity to take advantage of new programs that could be opening up. I would encourage you to do so. Also, for the social sciences, Cuba, of course, is going to be going through considerable transition in the years ahead. Economically, as Gustavo alluded to, the country has begun economic reforms that are opening up new opportunities for small-scale private entrepreneurship. There are new forms of market competition that are just beginning to transform Cuban society. This is going, it's not clear exactly how far this is going to go, and certainly Cuba remains predominantly a socialist economy, but it is an economy that is adopting certain mixed features, and so it's going to be very interesting as an economic experiment, in a sense, to try to track the changes and see what kinds of implications they have for Cuban society. And then certainly in the political sphere, Cuba is going to go through a generational change politically. There's no question about that. What the implications of that could be in terms of the larger political regime and how it relates to Cuban citizens, that's something that is still very much open to be determined, but it's certainly going to be a process that will be fascinating to observe and to study, both for scholars and for students. And so whatever particular field you may be in, I think that ultimately we all stand to benefit by the kinds of new opportunities that are likely to emerge to try to learn from Cuba.
Thanks, Ken.
If I can just make a point, Cornell has two undergraduate programs in Cuba, the one represented here. The other one, also in partnership with the University of Havana, is for students who have advanced Spanish who are taking their courses in humanities and social sciences. So this one can take students with an intermediate or advanced level of Spanish, and they can do research in one of two labs. Protein science or the bioacoustics, and the other is all four courses at the university. So it's a wonderful opportunity.
Kristen Grace, for you guys, Kristen Grace was just pointing out that Cornell now has two programs in Cuba, the one that you guys are part of, and one for students with more advanced Spanish, which is in association with Brown and is more of an immersion into the university. And I just want to thank those of you that are here. It's for you guys. It's a gorgeous day here, probably about the same temperature as it is in Havana, finally. Mm-hmm. And I really thank you, Len, for all the work that you did to make this come together and to make the facilities of the interest section available. I'm glad that Ian and Wesley were able to join. And on this side, I'm really happy that Robin and Walt were able to do backflips and make the video and audio work well for us. It's worked out really, really well, and thank you all.
We're glad that the storm has held off. Looks like the wind is blowing a little bit more, so I to your team, and it's really been a great opportunity. I hope we're doing more things like this in the future, and that Professor Isel and others, Professor Emmanuel, will also, you know, be able to take the opportunity to participate. So,
thanks,
anyway, thank you very much. It's great.